Hello, everyone. Welcome back to If Plants Could Talk. This is Garrett. I'm your host. This conversation took place on April 7th, 2024, with my very special guest, Dean of Gnosis Nursery. Dean joined me virtually today from his home and nursery space down in Ramona, California. That is in San Diego County. And he is an extremely knowledgeable botanist. We talked Dudleas in depth, Bursera, some of his adventures down in Baja, California, protecting plant species and habitat loss. He's got a ton of information in his mind and he's very brilliant. I really enjoyed his company and I hope you guys do too. I want to take a moment to tell you guys about my sponsors and partnerships. If you scroll down into the description of this episode, you will find links to Mezcala Nursery located in Long Beach, California. Green Touch Nursery located in Bellflower, California. Big shout out to Plantly.io. You can type in Plantly.io into your web browser or download the free Plantly app on Android or iOS. If you are interested in becoming a vendor, I have provided a link for you to do so down in the description. Next up is Real Mushrooms. Real Mushrooms is a mushroom supplement company offering hot water extracts in both powder and capsule form. You may be familiar with all of these mushrooms and their wonderful health benefits like lion's mane, chaga, reishi, shiitake, maitake, cordyceps, all these mushrooms that have been used in Chinese herbal medicine to treat an array of ailments. There are articles in the description of this episode, or you can check out my episode with Jeff Chilton to learn more. And if you're ready to make a purchase, use my link or type in code if plants could talk at checkout, and you will get 10% off your order. Next up is PlantWave. PlantWave is a device that translates the electrical frequencies and patterns that your plant creates. In other words, the water moving through your plant creates an electrical frequency, and that is then translated into sound and melodies using the PlantWave app and the PlantWave device. You hook up two electrodes to your plant or perhaps mushroom, and you can tune out of the world and tune into your plants. Here is an example of some mushroom music. If you're ready to make a purchase, there is no code necessary. Just click the link and you will actually get $20 off your PlantWave device. And last but not least is Bad Ghost Botanicals. Bad Ghost Botanicals is offering a supplement powder that is a nootropic. One of their products is called Flow State, and it is made out of lion's mane, ginseng, and Metragynous speciosa or kratom. They also offer Metragynous speciosa by itself. They have a green mang da. So if you're ready to make a purchase, you can use my link or type in code if plants could talk at checkout, and you will get 15% off your order. All right, here is Dean Karras of Gnosis Nursery. Welcome to If Plants Could Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Garrett.
I'm honored to have you, man. We've talked about it for quite some time, a little bit. We've gone back and forth a little bit about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
And I've listened to a lot of the podcasts you've done, especially the episodes with a lot of my friends. So, I think you've interviewed Julian and Jess and Freeze and Zach. So some nice folks in the plant community. I love hearing my friends talk to you. And I feel like even though I know these folks decently well, you're good at getting people to open up in a way that I learn a lot about other people. So it's been nice.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Zach, when you say Zach, you're talking about Zap Tropicals?
Yeah.
I
Yeah,
couldn't
that's right.
remember who Zach was.
Oh, and then
Cool.
also
Shout out
Zach,
to Zach.
you did Atacan recently too.
Oh yeah, that Zach. Yeah,
Yeah.
of course. He's awesome, man.
They're both good guys.
Cool. So I was asking you beforehand where you're joining me from today.
I am at my house in Ramona, California. So it's East County, San Diego, about an hour outside of the city.
Okay, cool. And that's on site at Gnosis Nursery, correct?
It's synonymous with, well, it's funny because more recently, I have this idea that Gnosis Nursery isn't a physical place so much as an idea. And this is just a physical instance of it, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But it's on site with where I run shop.
Okay, where did this idea come from?
You know, so there's been some turmoil in my personal life over the last few years. Some of it catalyzed by the pandemic, which is also when I opened the nursery
Sure.
and started doing the plant gig full time. And so I've taken a step back from running the nursery full time, and just kind of have it as a side gig now. I'm working some other offsite jobs in the meantime after doing it basically nonstop as my full time day job for 3.5 years. And it was in a conversation with a friend. He's like, "So no more Gnosis Nursery?" And I was like, it was funny because even aside from like running at a smaller capacity, doing cactus shows and stuff, I was like, no, like there will always be Gnosis Nursery. I'm just not. I can't go all in the way I was anymore, if that
So,
makes sense.
would you argue that the nursery itself wouldn't have to exist and Gnosis Nursery would still exist? Like you wouldn't have to have the space. Is that
I feel like
true?
it's almost like it's like a persona or a manifestation of my work with plants, right? So I think when I die, maybe Gnosis Nursery will die for whatever that's worth, because I don't know that I have a protege to carry on the torch. I don't know that I'll ever find one. And that's okay. That's like not something I'm really planning for right now. I'm only 35, so I think I still have some time. But yeah, it's more of an idea, especially too, like I was thinking too. I started the Instagram page on, I think back in like 2018 or so. I wasn't on social media at all for like a whole decade. And when I was talking about opening a business, someone's like, "Oh, you really should get on Instagram. It's a really good platform. It's basically free advertising." And so I kind of learned how to do that. And the more I've been on Instagram, the less my content has anything to do with the actual like nursery, like the plants I'm growing, and more just like other plants that I see that inspire me. So a lot of like habitat stuff when I have the chance to go out into the desert.
Yeah, I see those videos and I relate to that statement as well. And yeah, I appreciate what you're doing you strike me as like a unique individual, and I would love to hear a little bit about where the name Gnosis came from for those that
Yeah,
may not be
so
familiar with like Gnosticism or something.
yeah, that's kind of the core idea. So my dad's a Greek immigrant, and I learned a little bit of Greek growing up, but he wasn't around a lot. He was working a lot when I was growing up, so I never really had the opportunity to learn Greek from him. And the rest of the family still lives in Greece. I haven't visited them in a while, but growing up, we would go there and visit the family. So he came over as an immigrant at the age of 16, for a better life. And one of the ways I had to connect with him, since I didn't learn Greek growing up in the household, we didn't really speak it a whole lot, which is one of our mutual regrets. I studied ancient Greek in college, and I was also a philosophy. I was a philosophy Greek double major. And so there was this idea. So gnosis is one of the words for knowledge in ancient Greek, and it has a lot of kind of mystical and esoteric symbolism, especially in like the Neoplatonic tradition and the Christian Gnostic tradition. But for me, it was more just the idea of any kind of experiential knowledge. And I think it's a perfect metaphor for what gardening is, both as you get better at gardening, growing plants, and interacting with plants by doing it. You have to walk the path. And I think that there's also a lot of self-discovery and self-knowledge that you obtain by doing it, by walking the path. So you can read endless books or watch YouTube videos about how to grow cacti from seed, and like that's useful, but until you actually do it yourself and troubleshoot and experience failure, you don't have that kind of knowledge.
Absolutely. Now, when it comes to gardening for you, are you self-taught, or have you done any traditional means of educating for that?
Yeah, I'm pretty much self-taught.
Awesome.
I've never taken a horticulture class in my life. I've been working in the horticulture industry even before opening the nursery. But that was more just like a means to like, how else can I acquire more skills and kind of know what the industry is like? So I was working in a local retail nursery. But yeah, just growing plants, it was just a lot of trial and error and reading books, reading things online, trying new things. And so I'm really inspired, especially by the people that come up with new techniques for growing plants, because it's like it's a gardening's as old as human civilization growing food, but people are still coming up with new ways of doing it.
Yeah, I've been super impressed by like those vertical gardens that people are doing, and they're like doing is it aeroponics, or I don't know, I
Sure.
think it's hydroponics and aeroponics.
Yeah, like the Dutch are like killing it, and they have been for decades now, like basically creating hydroponics, bringing it to like next level science. And I don't really have a whole lot of interest in that. That's like a really dialed in, super scientific approach to gardening, and that's not really my style. I think there's a lot of good science behind any good gardener. Like there's, facts matter. There are things that work and things that don't. But But yeah, I think working, I take a little bit more of a permaculture approach and trying to work with nature rather than against it. So like I'm getting bug problems, you know, I might spray for bugs, but I'll ask myself too, like, why are they showing up here? Is there not good airflow? Is there not like the right cultural conditions? Not enough light, too damp, like what's going on? And how can I solve the problem or preempt the problem without just like applying more fertilizer, applying more pesticides?
Do you mind describing in layman's terms what permaculture means?
Yeah, permaculture is a nature-centered approach to working with nature. It's a portmanteau of permanent culture or permanent agriculture. And so it's the idea of planting perennials as opposed to turning the soil every year to like plant annuals. Although a lot of permaculturalists are still growing peppers and tomatoes and cucumbers and all the classic like annual veggies. But the idea is, how do we practice, like, rather than using a tractor to like till the land and then throw down a bunch of fertilizer and seed, how do we create natural systems that stay in place that then continue to build over time? It's like building soil health, you know, and I think that it's just a mindset for approaching how to work more efficiently by working with rather than against nature.
And it seems like during this time it would be a really appropriate time for us to try to hone in on that, and I would love to learn more about it personally. And there's an issue, right, with the soil kind of, it's dying. I've
Yeah,
heard something about
exactly.
like the soil isn't sustainable the way that we're growing plants, growing food in particular.
Sure, absolutely. Well, that and I mean, topsoil is a huge carbon sink. So like when we lose all the organic matter in the soil, then we need to use more, there's more inputs, there's greater input costs. A lot of the inputs are coming from petrochemicals, so that's not sustainable. And in the process, we're actually the carbon sink that should be the topsoil on the earth is being lost and basically re-entering the atmosphere. And it's, I mean, there's all kinds of like, I think we're, it's in so far as we all drive a car, we're all guilty for contributing to climate change. The same is true of gardening. Like there's a lot of externalities to the industry that are like not so green. And having worked for like larger nurseries where I haven't had as much control, I've kind of seen that. And it's like we kind of do our best. We're trying to all be as green as possible, but there's a lot of like single-use plastics in the nursery industry. And then another thing that's like extremely unsustainable is the use of peat moss. So peat moss is a frequent soil ingredient, especially for like potting soil mixes. And they're basically decomposed, partially decomposed bogs, which are huge carbon sinks that are basically being removed. And then all of that's now entering the waste stream where it's no longer sequestered in the earth.
And are they destroying the habitat of these bogs? Like the plants
Yeah,
that would normally
I think
grow
that's
there?
part of it. I think the bigger issue is that we're taking a lot of carbon that's already stored in the earth and then releasing it back without, you know, and it's like we're relying on bogs that were made over hundreds and sometimes thousands of years, and they're not being replaced at the same rate that they were created or that we're mining them. And so at a certain point, that's a finite resource.
What's a good alternative to peat moss?
I'm a big fan of coco coir. And a lot of cactus succulent growers say it holds too much water, or it's too salty is like another major criticism from the past. There's good and there's bad coco coir out there, but it's ground coconut husk, and so it's a renewable, and it has a lot of beneficial properties. It does hold a lot of moisture. I'm really far inland, so it gets really hot and dry out here. But one of the nice properties about coco coir is it holds moisture, but not at the expense of oxygen. As long as you got enough grits in the mix, you know, pumice or perlite or whatever.
Well, I hope this doesn't take us too far off track, but I'm going to rewind a little bit. Can you tell me a
Yeah,
little
sure.
bit about what brought you to gardening? When did you first discover these plants?
That's a really good question. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and I felt very disconnected with nature. And the irony is there is that now, like, deserts are my favorite ecosystem. I love desert plants or you know, arid xeric landscapes. But I think it was where I lived. I lived in a little bit of like a suburban bubble. There wasn't a lot of communal space like parks or places to be outside. And then being in the low desert, it's unpleasant to be outside at least 6 to 8 months out of the year just because it's so hot. And when your daily lows are sometimes 90 degrees, you know, you can go outside and it's like there's heat radiating off the concrete and it's like 100 degrees. You have to wear sandals at midnight, otherwise you'll burn your feet, kind of environment. And so I felt really disconnected from nature. And then when I moved to the Bay Area to go to school, I just started seeing all kinds of plant life. Like people gardened in a way that they don't really, I think, in harsher Sonoran desert type climates. And I was really fascinated. I just started like plucking little succulents from people's yards, which I feel bad about now, but like little like clusters of sempervivums, there's 100 heads. I would just like pick one and try propagating it and having a lot of success. It's also an extremely mild and accommodating climate for growing things. And I just got fascinated in propagating things. And then coinciding with that, there was also I started getting really interested in shamanism and ethnobotany. And so I got interested in like plant drugs, things that would alter consciousness. So my first cactus was the San Pedro cactus, and that's what really got me into cacti.
Love that.
And the more I continued to study, it's funny because I think it was the mindset was like, I'm going to grow plants, I'm going to use them. I'm going to have try to have some kind of experience consuming plants. And I'm no way opposed to that, but that lost its novel to me really quickly. And I got more and more into growing the plants. The addiction became the plants themselves and just growing the plants for the sake of the plants.
Yeah, of course. That makes
So,
sense. I feel like
yeah.
that's a understated, beautiful part of gardening is propagation. Because in the early stages of me gardening too, it was like the first thing that showed me, oh wow, I can do this. Like,
Yeah.
you know what I mean? I just ripped a leaf off of this, and now I've got two plants. So yeah, that's really cool, man.
Life finds a way for sure. And especially with like a lot of the cacti and succulents, like it's like I've had cacti that like I feel bad I've like somehow overlooked or neglected. They're sitting on concrete for a year, like trying to grow roots into the concrete. And then like I lift them up over a year later and just plop them on a little patch of soil, and then they grow like gangbusters. And it's just like, wow, that's a will to survive right there.
Really though, yeah, it is. So the shamanism, were you interested in that prior to going to the Bay Area, or was there something about the Bay Area that brought that up in you?
I think I'd been interested in like a little bit of the 60s counterculture. And I think some of it was like seeing through like the drug war propaganda, like drugs are evil, and just learning about the history of the reaction against the, I guess, the psychedelic aspect of the counterculture movement. And it's been interesting because since that interest blossomed in me, you know, circa 2008, and since then we've actually seen quite a like psychedelic renaissance. With a lot of research going on, organizations like MAPS and Johns Hopkins doing like MDMA and psilocybin trials. And I think that's really interesting science. But it always kind of bothered me that I saw this trend that studying philosophy made me realize that there are different modalities and different ways of thought, and that some of those are even culturally determined, and that it's important that we can all share like common sensus reality. Like we more or less live in the same reality and can agree, you know, the sky is blue and the earth is firm and I can walk on it. But also, having highly subjective and mystical experiences can cause people to view the world in a different way. And I think some of those things are powerful too. They speak to kind of ineffable things that I think our extremely materialistic culture loses sight of sometimes.
Do you mind exploring in what ways those tools helped you grow or you benefited from? Because it sounds like, based on what I talked to you, I spoke to you briefly once before, and you told me that you didn't, you never had, you described addiction as having your mind hijacked, and I like that. I like that description. I think it's accurate. So, if you were you seeking to heal mentally, or were you seeking spiritual growth? What was it that you were looking for?
I think initially I was seeking experience just for the sake of like, you know, why do people do that? Like the
Curiosity.
thing, like what curiosity? Yeah, totally, 100% curiosity.
Sure.
Like, why do people do these? Why do people then report having these like absolutely transcendental experiences, and almost become like evangelical about it. There seems to be this
They
trend.
do.
Yeah. And so like there was that, but I think more and more it was less about novelty for me and my own experiences and more realizing that there's actual there I think this the psychedelics can be tools for self-discovery because I think that used properly, they can cause a lot of self-transparency. And that can be processing things we try to repress or just trying to better understand ourselves. And so I think some of that, for me, I don't actually partake very often anymore. And when I do it pretty consciously. I try to a few times a year, and I think that that's all I need. It's like helping unpack some things that I think that in my normal waking reality don't really want to think about or confront. And
Avoidance,
yeah,
things that you
exactly.
might be
Totally.
avoiding, pushing down.
Yeah, and it makes sense. It's like it's easier to push things down than to deal with them, especially if you just have to like get through the day, you know, get work done or whatever society the expectation society places on us. But taking time out to unpack and grapple with those things can be helpful. And I think like one of the things that I sort of realized and I still get benefit from working with is I'm on the autism spectrum. And I didn't know that until I was like in my late 20s. And it was kind of I'm like kind of self-diagnosed neurodivergent. But it's like it's funny that it's like I've had this my whole life, but then not really even realized this about myself. And so that's something that I've been continuing to unpack in the last few years. And I think that psychedelics have been useful with that. Just understanding how it changes how I relate to people a lot. And so like there's stereotypes about autistic people not being empathetic. And I think that's true. I think my empathy threshold, especially for strangers, is like maybe a little lower than average. But it's I think that the way that we empathize or relate to people is fundamentally different. And so that's one of the things I love about plants and the plant community is I very much relate to people about things. Like if someone is interested in something and I don't share common interests, it's really hard for me to find a authentic connection with them. But if we have a mutual interest, I just get like so wrapped up in like talking about something and wanting to hear what someone else feels about that same topic. And so I very much relate to people about things.
Well, if there was a lack of empathy, I don't think you would have the capacity for such self-awareness, man. So
Yeah.
I you know what I mean?
Sure.
You seem like you're pretty tuned in, you know.
It's a journey still. Yeah, I mean, we're all still working on ourselves, right?
Sure, of course, man. That's beautiful to hear. I've actually heard few reports of that, but the sum of people on the spectrum benefiting from things like psilocybin, it's
Yeah.
just beautiful to see how many different applications there are, and it just continues to grow and evolve, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
People
Yeah,
using
it's really
them in their
exciting.
life.
It's exciting that it's becoming a thing now. It's becoming more. It's in the news. People are talking about it. It's becoming more normalized. So yeah, I'm excited to see how that continues to develop in the future.
Cool. How much do you know about what is that place called in ancient Greece? Was it Ulysses or what
Oh,
was
the
it?
rites of Ulysses.
Elos?
Yeah, Ulysses.
Ulysses.
You know, I've done some research on that. It appears that they were consuming because I think it was a based around Demeter, who's like a fertility god, but also an agrarian or goddess. And the best theory out there seems like they were consuming some kind of ergot type fungus.
Like
So
bread mold.
bread mold, yeah, bread mold, like LSD precursors. But no one knows for sure because I think aside from a few statues, there's a few writings on it, like Plato writes about it. And that's like all we know. So it's kind of piecing things together, but based around it, the worshiping Demeter, who was associated with wheat and grain, and the fact that it was appeared to be some kind of like psychedelic initiatory thing, that's probably what they were doing. They were consuming like ergot.
That's fascinating. And
Yeah.
that very well may have inspired some of those writings of ancient
Yeah,
Greece.
absolutely. Yeah, people have talked about maybe that it inspired Plato's idea of the cave and like kind of Platonic idealism and the idea that there's this the world we kind of just naively interpret as all of our sense perceptions is really just kind of like a veil, like an illusion foisted upon us, and the true reality is deeper and beyond that.
Cool.
Yeah.
I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to dive deeper into gardening with you, because from my understanding, I do know that you present often in cactus and succulent society shows on certain species of plants. Yeah.
I've done some talks with the Cactus Succulent Societies. They've typically been centered around travels I've done, mostly in Baja. So like if I visit a particular location or place, these are the plants I saw there, which is usually, that's cute, kind of usually the Cactus Succulent Society lecture archetype is like, sure. Yeah.
Plants and habitat.
Plants and habitat, yeah.
Now you have a particular favorite, right? And it's Dudleya. Is that accurate?
I really love the Dudleyas. It's funny because I don't love growing them. And that was one of the things I realized. I've grown them. I've grown them from seed. I've grown, you know, I bought plants and like grown them out. I've grown them from cuttings. And it's not like they're fussy. It's more that, what's the right way to describe this? I love how they grow in habitat. I love like they just don't look cool in a pot.
Sure.
The way they look cool, like hanging from rock cliffs.
Yeah.
And I've seen gardens that try to emulate that to a greater or lesser extent, but it's just one of those things like nature does it best. And the other thing that I love about the Dudleyas is I'm surprised by like where I find them, because they're the, if you look at like the center of distribution for the Dudleyas, it's basically San Diego County down to the tip of Baja, north to like the very southern border of Oregon, mostly coastally distributed. And then there's some oddball ones that occur like deeper into the desert. And the desert ones always surprise me because it's like harsh desert. And then if there's a boulder or a rock crevice in the right place that creates shade most of the day, there might be a Dudleya and then like a fern sticking out of it. And you're like, how is this soft succulent and this fern growing in such like a harsh desert ecosystem?
Well, forgive me for my ignorance. I see them growing out of the rocks here in Topanga Canyon, and I see them growing. I saw them in Big Sur this past weekend, but I'm not super familiar. I don't understand. Are they mostly in inorganic medium?
Yeah, I think
they're
the
just
Topanga
growing
Canyon
straight out
ones.
Of rocks.
Yeah, the Topanga Canyon ones, you might be seeing Cymosa, which is like the canyon Dudleya, and it usually grows on like vertical rock faces.
Yeah, straight up cliffs.
So yes and no, and that's another thing that's really cool about it, and you don't see these in like cultivated specimens, although I'm sure people do try. It's just difficult to succeed. So they actually have a symbiosis with mosses, as well as with this vascular plant, a whole genus of vascular plants called Selaginella, which are spike mosses. And you froze there for a second. Are
back?
We live again? Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to the moss connection.
Yeah, so there's this stuff called spike moss, Selaginella. It's a big genus, and it looks like moss. It's actually a vascular plant, during the dry season, it goes like very, very dormant, kind of crusty dry. But it kind of has the properties of like soil or peat moss, in that it creates like a little nursery for little seedlings to germinate on. And so when you see like Dudleyas and how they're actually able to grow, it's like seeds dropping into these little pads of moss like medium that grow in the same places that Dudleyas grow, that provides like a little nursery for them. And there's other like cacti do it too. So like you've seen like Canisarius cacti and Mammillaria cacti in habitat. But the spike mosses are actually really, really crucial for growing Dudleyas. And so like when the big fire burned down a big portion of like the Dudleya viridii population, it basically wiped out like 90% of the population. Then when they were doing research, they started actually culturing like spike moss onto the medium and then sowing seeds in that and having way higher success and germination rate so that they could then plant them back out in the wild.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I see like a resemblance. What differentiates them between Echeveria and Dudleya?
So it's funny because that question still confuses Google. If you just type in Dudleya on Google search and then hit images, or even just the main page, one of the first pictures that shows up is actually like Echeveria colorata or one of the other. And it's funny that even like with how smart AI is and getting it like still messes that up royally. They're similar. It's where the inflorescence comes from is a major difference. So on the echeverias, the inflorescence comes from further down. And then it's funny because even though morphologically a lot of the rosette type Dudley is more closely resemble the echeverias, they're actually more closely related to sedum, which is also in Crassulaceae, which is just a giant family of soft succulents that includes New World stuff, Old World stuff. But then there's a lot of oddball Dudleas where the logic of having a rosette is a lot more obscured. So like Dudleya edulis or Vicida have kind of these long, pointy leaves that almost look kind of like grass-like in a way. And there is a rosette in there, but it's not clear like a lot of the rosette forming species like that it's a rosette. And then there's other ones. There's a whole like subgenus of Dudleyas that lose all parts above ground during the dry season
Oh,
and
really?
retreat down to a bulb called, yeah, it used to be a different genus called Hasianthus, and it's been grouped under Dudleya. And some of those have weird growth forms where they're not rosette like at all. So like Dudleya brevifolia are like looks like these little clusters of pebbles, and they grow in ironstone fields, and they basically look like the little ironstone, like basically little like rusted musket balls that grow that are in that area. And
Cool.
so yeah, they're like medium distance relatives to the echeverias, but they don't overlap with any of the echeverias in habitat. So the Dudleyas are basically mostly in winter rainfall areas, and then even the summer rainfall areas of Baja, because the southern portion, especially the eastern seaboard, Baja is more summer rainfall. But basically, as soon as the Dudleyas stop, when you're in like Mexico, as you get into like North Mexico, down into tropical Mexico, that's where the echeverias, to my understanding, begin. I've never seen any of the echeverias in habitat.
Wow, so they're completely separated, habitat-wise.
Yeah, and it's weird too. There's some weird some of the Dudleya species even do that, where one Dudleya species ends, the next one begins. So
How
Dudley
interesting.
arizonica is a great example of that. It's basically like the desert counterpart of Dudleya pulverlenta, the common chalk Dudleya that grows all along the coast in Southern California. It grows, out here. Even I'm 40 miles from the coast, so it grows this far inland, up through the mountains of Julian at high elevation, up to about like 4,000 to 4,500 feet. And then as soon as you're on the other side of Julian and drop down in the desert, like into the rain shadow in Anza-Borrego area, you'll see Dudleya arizonica instead of Dudleya pulverlenta. They basically don't ever really cross in habitat, but they grow in many instances just within a few miles of each other. And where the one species drops out, then the other one begins.
And do they mostly propagate by like seed blowing in the wind or?
Yeah,
Yeah.
seed dispersal.
Cool. Seed dispersal. I'm learning all kinds of stuff today, Dean.
Right on.
This is awesome, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of the farina? Like, why does it exist?
So a few things. The two that I can think of off the top of my head is it's sunblock. So because a lot of plants will have farina for sunblock. And then the other major purpose of the farina is it's extremely hydrophobic. And so some of
Protects
the
the plant.
coastal species, like it's funny that something like Dudleya Brittonii is the whitest of any of the Dudleyas. It's got actually, I think it's got the densest, whitest farina of any plant, if I understand correctly. And that's a really coastal species. So you'd think, well, with all the marine layer and less intensity of the sun, it's a low elevation, so there's less UV intensity. It doesn't need as thick of a farina. But you'll see, if it's in an area that gets a lot of fog drip and marine layer moisture, if that was somehow able to penetrate the plant, it could cause rot. And so a lot of times you see Dudleyas, in cultivation, but also out in the wild, whether it's just dew settling or a recent rain event, you'll frequently see beads of water on the leaves of the really farinose Dudleyas, and you'll see like some of the chalk mixing in with the water, but it's causing them to like stay beaded up where it's not then like entering the rosette and causing rot.
And it does not reform if it is removed.
It doesn't appear to. I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't finger fuck my Dudleys to the point where like they get the farina removed. I just like know better than to do that, you know?
Sure.
And it's funny, it's one of the things that like Cactus shows too, where it's like, oh, you know, there's always do not touch signs, but people are always like hesitant to bring in their nice Dudleys for that reason, because they don't, you know, it takes like one streak to like really mess it up for like a year.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, in these adventures in Baja, what other kind of species have you really been focusing in on?
That's a really, really tough question because there's just so much cool stuff. And I'm realizing that too. Like, I love Baja. It's got a special place in my heart. I've been privileged enough to be able to travel there. It's also like literally right in my backyard. I've gone down to see like Dudley of Britanni on day trips a few times before, because it can go down, you know, wake up at like 6 a.m., go down, spend some time in habitat, get tacos in Ensenada, and get back across the border before, you know, before it's late at night. But I think being in habitat generally, I now that if I'm planning a trip, even if it's just like a quick day trip out into Anzabrego Desert, I always have a destination in mind based on a plant I want to see or plants I want to see. And what always astounds me are the other plants I observe and notice that I either didn't even know existed or wasn't expecting to find there.
Sure.
And that's like the more I go, it's like a tease, because like no matter what I see, there's always more that I'm turned on to just by going out there. So I think more and more, like, I'm not so great with leafy plants, but more and more I'm getting into like native plants that are non-succulent in nature. And there's so many rad plants out there. I wish I had lifetimes to like study them all. But it's that. And then the other thing that's really cool is when you start to become familiar with certain species. Some of the species have really narrow distribution and some have really wide distribution. It's kind of cool seeing like the co-occurrences of different species. Like, oh, in this spot, these three things grow together. In this spot, this one species also grows, but it grows with these two like other totally different plants that I wouldn't expect to find in like a grouping.
Awesome, man. It would appear that you've done a lot of studying. You've got a lot of information in the front of your mind.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I also like know the good plant nerds to hang out with, because like
Sure.
people way, way, way more knowledgeable about and smarter than myself about plants. So I try to like pick their brains as often as possible.
Cool. So does your heart lie anywhere in particular? Or is
Like
it just
geographically or with plants?
with plants?
Always cactus. Cactus is my first
Okay.
love,
Okay.
and got me more into the other succulents. Jeez. Most recently, I've been really into the Bursaras,
Okay.
for two reasons. I think they're just really cool form-wise, and I love smelly plants. I love plants that smell good, and a lot of the Bursaras actually have history of like ethnomedical use,
Yeah.
as like incenses or fragrances, or even like topically, or even internally in some cases.
Talking like myrrh, frankincense, those kinds of plants.
Yeah, so those are both old world from Boswellia and Commiphora, but those are in the greater Bursaraceae in that family. And so
Okay.
even some of the new world species have reports of indigenous use, which I think is really interesting. I think there's a lot of plant knowledge out there that's sadly been lost and is
Yeah.
continuing to be lost. And then insofar as it is being discovered, it's frequently for like really exploitative purposes of like, how do we patent a medicine out of this and kind of like cut out the kind of indigenous legacy or claim to right over that. But I think for me, just like really good plant smells, they're so complex, and there's like nothing else like it. Like
Yeah.
for the bursas too, like I can't, or like desert lavender is another great one. It just grows out in the desert. It's a pretty unassuming plant. It's pretty, but like I can't walk by one and not like rub my hands all over it. And then I'm just like smelling my hands for like hours afterwards. You know?
Wonderful.
Yeah. And then sometimes I just get like a whole like rainbow of smells on my hands, you know, where it's just like I've touched so many smelly plants. It's like the white sage and then the desert lavender and then like the bursaras, that it's like all of the flavors kind of like smells combining together. So
What's the bursar life cycle like? How long do some of these species live?
that's a good question. I don't know if anyone knows. I don't think they're like absurdly old.
They're
Like
slow
I think
growing though, correct?
yes, but and I haven't put any in the ground yet, but I've seen people that do, and they seem to grow much faster in the ground. So it seems to be one of those plants that like really sends out roots pretty far to make use of a very little bit of rainfall. They're fairly slow in containers. I don't know. I've been collecting more and really trying to like push growth on them to decent effect, like repotting them every year. Mm-hmm. And that seems to really help. Probably a few hundred years for like some of the old ones. Yeah.
Are they like technically trees?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's a tree?
A good question.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there's good definitions of what a tree is. It's funny because like they are, I guess, trees, but then that's one of the lovely things about seeing bursars in habitat is sometimes they grow like totally procumbent. It'll be a plant that's like 8 or 10 feet wide and like 2 feet off the ground.
Right.
And that's usually caused by like extreme wind in coastal areas where a lot of the plants that normally would grow taller inland where there's less wind just like get totally flattened out by the wind.
Are they under any threat like the Mexican frankincense, for example?
I lost you there for just a second.
Yeah, me too. No
worries. What were you asking?
I was asking, is the Mexican frankincense, for example, under any type of threat for its habitat?
So
is our population thriving?
That's a good question. I don't think any of the bursaras in Baja anyways, like Phaeacoides, are threatened yet.
Okay.
A sad reality that we're facing with Baja species though, and I learned this on my last trip there. We had I don't know if you follow Baja Nativa, Glenn, on Instagram. Yeah, so I just kind of linked up with him on Instagram about 2 years ago because I was posting a bunch of Baja stuff and he was commenting on it and giving me interesting tips and plant information. And so recently there's a Dudleya chat, but a group of five of us that are all in the Dudleya chat planned a trip to the Cape region in Baja to look at specifically some Dudleya species and see other things there as well. And so the Cape region has a really, really high level of like all of the peninsula has a lot of endemic species, but it's really like a biodiversity hotspot right there in the Cape region. And that includes some of the, like the endemic bursaras. And like, I think they're not threatened yet, but they're also not really protected in the sense that they should be. So the collecting them is illegal, like poaching them is illegal. And the Mexican government would do things about that. But there doesn't seem to be anything stopping the development. And so basically every single last, every single last mile of the Cape region has been basically sold to real estate developers at this point, basically to build hotels and resorts and, fancy houses and condos for expats. And so that area in the next few decades is going to undergo really, really massive development.
Bummer, man.
Because, yeah. And so that was one of the sad things. Like Glenn was an awesome guy. He took us around to a lot of his spots, but we were even just in like Cabo San Lucas, which is like, a spring break, like party destination. And we were in one of the few like public parks and like hiking trails from like where he grew up. And he's like, this is all sold. This is all going to be developed in the next 5 years, and there was just like hillsides littered with multiple Mammillaria species and Dudleas and an endemic agave species. And so I guess that was a really long answer to a concise question, but yeah, a lot of these aren't being properly protected. So
I feel like, are there safeguards in place for plants like that when it comes to development? Like if we look at Texas, this is two questions in one.
Yeah.
Are there safeguards at all in place? Because I don't know. And two, would you argue that the development problem is more severe than the poaching problem when it comes to areas like Texas and this Baja region?
Yeah. So it really depends on the population, right? And there's some things where poaching is the primary threat, and there's other things where development or habitat loss essentially is the primary threat. Right. And there's frequently both that co-occur.
Yeah.
And it just kind of depends. It's on a plant by plant basis. It's There's money involved. So like with developing the Cape region and Baja, like it's not, what are the competing interests, and how would a government like the Mexican government make decisions to are you going to completely halt progress? How do you protect select plants? Who's making those decisions? This is one of the things that's really I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know if there is just the right answer.
Sure, it's complex.
Yeah, it's a complex problem. It's a species, like I don't know much about birds or reptiles. And so like I wouldn't be a good stakeholder for making decisions about protecting those kinds of species. Plants are important to me, and so I feel really vested in like trying to protect plants,
Yeah,
but
yeah.
then we can't halt progress altogether, right?
Sure.
That's just like this, like especially in like take Southern California, there's like, or San Diego County is a perfect example of like there's not enough affordable housing in San Diego County.
Yeah.
The solution to making more affordable housing is to build it. And that's generally not happening on like, already developed land. Like it might be building ADUs in backyards or whatever. That's not really going to solve the housing problem. It's basically turning virgin land into apartments or new housing developments. And so I think there's always this opportunity cost and trade-off.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna like, go on a podium and say, like development is bad. We shouldn't have it.
Yeah.
I think that what we need to do is we need to put resources into documenting what's there. And
Yeah.
we can't say what we don't know exists. And
Sure.
that's one of the things that, there's species out there that still haven't been discovered. And so like we saw three Dudleya species or four taxa total. One was like a subspecies on the week-long trip I did back in March. And one of those species has some documentation, even as far back as Reid Moran, who's a famous botanist who did a lot of work in Baja and on some of the Channel Islands. So there's like reports of this weirdo Dudleya that doesn't fit the other Dudleya definitions. But this species still doesn't have a name and hasn't been formally described to science. And so like it's bizarre to me to like even see things in habitat that I can't say, this is Dudleya such and such. Like this
Right.
is Dudleya, species undescribed.
Yeah.
Like that's wild to me with how long humans have been studying plants, that there's still stuff out there to be discovered. Or Glenn and Abraham, who are two of the botanists that were on the trip too, we went there's a large mountain range in the center of the Cape region, Sierra La Laguna. It goes to about 6,500 feet. And there's a lot of it used to be an island, actually. At one point, geologically in its history, it was totally separated from the rest of the peninsula. And so you get, in addition to just having like the peninsula species speciation occurring over periods of time because of geological separation, it was actually an island for some period of time. But they discovered a new species, and they still don't know what genus it even belongs to. It's
Wow.
they've kind of they were so one of the reasons they went on the trip with us was to see the plants again and take measurements and do more documenting. And they were hoping to find flowers because that would help them, of course. Like flowers are the gold standard for identifying or categorizing plants. And so there's some kind of monocot plant in Aspergaceae, genus unknown, that they're hopefully going to be able to discover and or like report, and describe formally. But
Wow.
yeah, that was weird. It was weird looking at a plant that doesn't have a name.
Well, it would be horrible for land to be developed where there very well could be an undiscovered species. Can some of these plants be moved and or saved, rehabilitated? Is there anything that can be done like that if you're
Yeah,
going to
yes.
destroy it anyways?
Well, so my friend James was saying that's like one of the really tragic things when they're doing development, especially in like Baja Sur, is like they'll just plow under a field of like gorgeous bursaras. And it's but like they're not super rare down there, and
Sure,
it was that
sure,
was the
sure.
really trippy thing. When I got back from the trip, I was because like in Cabo San Lucas area and San Jose del Cabo, which are like two little towns on the very southern part of the peninsula, you're like they use like Bursa microphyllas, like 8-foot-tall bursaras, as like street trees. They're like planted in the median, like
Cool.
every like 10 feet, and you're like, holy fuck, that's like a next level bursar. Oh, there's another one. There's like 20 of them planted in a row.
Wow.
You know, and so it's like they're not scarce there, you know.
Sure.
It's not necessarily an endangered plant, and there's no real, like, you know, and then you think about, okay, they're being plowed under, that's tragic. What's the alternative? The alternative is like, what, dig them up and sell them to collectors? Like, that doesn't seem like any better really to me.
Sure.
It doesn't seem like it would really satiate the demand. And I think that's one of the big problems with like poached plants, is it's this like infinite demand for these, like, it's like trophy hunting, you know. It's like everyone wants the like lion head on their fucking wall to be like, you know, this is something I own. And so like with habitat plants, a lot of the ones that, especially the really high end ones that you see in the poached plants, you know, on Instagram accounts in wherever, other countries mostly, but like, it's people are prizing these plants for how gnarled and unique the characteristic of a given plant is, not just that it's that species.
Right.
So I don't know.
What about a sanctuary? Like, you know, if they're going to develop there anyways, can they be dug up, moved, and put into a sanctuary? And who's to discount like the life of one individual Brucera, for example, just because it's prevalent or abundant?
Sure.
You know, like, how do we know that plant's not conscious? And like,
sure.
You know, especially if it's been there for, you said some of these things could be, you know, a century or old.
Yeah. So actually, that's one of the really funny thing. This is like throughout the Baja Peninsula, you'll see a lot of the landscaping, like when you're in a town, will be like a row of like farro cactus at even intervals, and like it's whatever the native species is in that area, or like a row of cardones, you know, that look like artificially planted. And so there's kind of a cultural norm there, and I'm not in no way offended by this. I just find it fascinating that like you want to do a little bit of landscaping, you like go, you know, out into the field and just like dig up a few small plants and plant them in like a nice tidy row, you know. And it's like, well, at least they're planting native plants, even if they're like technically collecting them from the wild. You know, it's not like so you can ship it off to a collector in Asia. It's like to like repatriate it. So yeah, a lot of the military checkpoints, you'd be like out in the middle of nowhere, and they've dug up like cardones or whatever, and or boojums, and planted them in these like straight little rows. So I think salvage is like a real thing. You know, if you're gonna develop, it's best to extract the plants and at least try to plant them nearby. But yeah, I don't, it ultimately comes down to like habitat loss. And I think it's hard to choose again, but making some places are too special to lose.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is with a lot of like really like narrowly endemic species that might only grow in like a few square miles, that those places need to be protected from development, because otherwise those species will ostensibly cease to exist in the wild. And I think there is value to trying to grow plants outside of their native range, but this is really controversial, especially by the researchers, because there are problems with when you move, even if it's the same species, if it doesn't represent the genetic window of that population, and you add it to that, it could skew population genetics in a bad way. And so I don't know. I'm all for like doing a little bit of guerrilla gardening and trying to extend plant species ranges. But you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to play on things where they
playing
didn't.
Playing God at a certain point.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, humans have been doing that since we started, you know, moving around plants. And if you look at, that's one of the things that still blows my mind about Trichocereus distribution in the wild in South America. Uh-huh. Like, humans have been moving around those cacti as cuttings for at least like 4,000 years. Mm. And there's a lot of weird, there's no way to like go back in time travel and figure out which humans moved the cacti where.
Yeah.
And the fact that there are already so many Trichocereus species in different ecosystems in South America, anytime humans would have moved them from one place to another, they would have hybridized with whatever was already growing there and created kind of new types. And so there's certain wild populations of Trichocereus that are presumed to be kind of ancestral human created hybrid swarms from people moving cactus material around.
Is that what happened with North America's predominant cultivar? What happened there? How did we end up with that? And do we have any wild Trichocereus species that are not
There's
predominant?
no, well, so there's no Trichocereus native to North America. They're all South American cacti.
Okay.
I don't know the full story behind PC, other than at one point it just became mass propagated. And I don't know which nursery or if people even know who's exactly responsible for that. One of the reasons why it probably has persisted so well in cultivation is it's extremely hardy. It's an extremely vigorous and hardy San Pedro version. So it makes sense that, it is the one that, even if in like abandoned lots where people might have planted a cactus dozens of
Right.
years ago, like that's the one that persists. So then if people take cuttings from that, that's the one that passes on.
Would you argue that it's a completely separate species?
I don't know. I think the whole Trichocereus taxonomy is a huge mess. I don't think I'm clever enough of a botanist, to really make those kinds of determinations anyways.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
I know it's got a few really unique characteristics to it that suggest that it's not Echinopsis pachynoi. But some people think it's like Echinopsis or Trichocereus burgessii. Some people think it's a weird like burgessii relative, rheomyscensis. But like the problem with one of the problems with Trichocereus taxonomy, no one's really doing research on them
Yeah.
aside from like the enthusiasts here. The enthusiasts here are mostly like creating novel hybrids or selecting for phenotypes. They're not trying to study whole wild populations.
Right.
And so out in the wild, like no one's really doing like that I know of like field work on Trichocereus in the wild right now.
That's
And
unfortunate.
yeah, it's unfortunate. But it also is the case that like if you look at the old cactus books, there's like 70 or 80 plus Trichocereus species where that number should probably be around 30. And so that was like every time they went to a new locality and it looked different, they would call it a new species,
Right.
even if it really didn't meet the criteria for being distinct enough.
Like Cuscoensis versus Peruvianus. They're
Yeah,
pretty much the
exactly.
same exact thing.
Yeah, exactly. Or like there's a lot of confusion around like Joel Lode, who's done some taxonomy work. He's basically doing taxonomy work on the whole cactus family. He in his first volume, which kind of sorted things out at the genus level, he argues Trichocereus should be distinct from Echinopsis. It's nonsense grouping it with Echinopsis, but we're looking at about 30 species. And by the way, Trichocereus macrogonus and Peruvianus and pachynoi are all one species. It's one big species complex, basically, which seems right to me,
Yeah,
but
I agree.
it's also too like it, with any of these
Burgessii,
things.
I kind of is like a little bit different, though, or it would be
Yeah,
like more,
burgessii is definitely different.
right?
Burgessii is for sure different. It's like where do you want to draw the line? Like these are just human constructs,
Yeah.
right? And
Yeah.
that's like the biological species concept. This is like a problem with like philosophy of science. Biological species concept works awesome for animals, and then it breaks down with plants a lot because like and even with animals, there's problems. Like if A and B can beget offspring and B and C can beget offspring, then theoretically, the transitive property would be A, B, and C are all the same species. But if A and C can't make babies, even if A and B and B and C independently can, then they're not the same species.
Right.
And so like there's all kinds of like kind of paradoxes. And it doesn't help with like a lot of the pick a plant genus, aloes. So many of them will make hybrids. Trichocereus will make hybrids with Lobivias, with Echinopsis. So like that's not really a good standard. Even people have been able to cross things like Cleistocactus with Trichocereus and
Cool.
Echinopsis. So like if we want to use that, there'd be like a mega genus of Echinopsis with like hundreds and hundreds of species, and that no one really wants to see that.
Have you ever heard of anybody consuming PC with some success?
Yeah, it's active.
Thank you.
I know from personal experience. That was the first one I ever consumed.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fucking awesome, man. That I'm really glad to hear that. I've beat that topic to death, but I had in the early days of the podcast, the first few episodes, I had a some kind of plant biologist on, a friend from high school, and he did some testing on PC and determined that there it appeared to be active. He couldn't say definitively, but he had some evidence to suggest it was.
It is. It's just not super potent.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, that myth was circulating a lot on the internet. I remember like a decade ago.
Sure.
And I was like, no, that's, I mean, anyone, there were a lot of naysayers, and the naysayers were all people that had tried it, had done the human bioassay and proven it wrong.
Right.
So,
yeah. Interesting. For a moment, you were talking about the housing crisis earlier in San Diego. What do you think about the idea of utilizing these abandoned malls? I saw one the other day right by my house, and I'm like, it's just so decrepit and ran down. And it's like, why aren't we utilizing this? It doesn't even appear that they're going to be redeveloping some of these places. They're just lost to time.
I love that idea. I mean, there's an affordability in housing crisis all throughout, really in other parts of the country too, but especially in Southern California.
Yeah.
The problem's complex. I mean, the problem around the unhoused also has to do with lack of services for people that need it.
Yeah.
It's, we incarcerate people that really need mental health support.
Rehabilitation.
You know, rehabilitation. Well, and you know, it's like, it's the rehabilitation system, but like,
sure.
So you go to jail for like a petty drug felony,
yeah,
and then you exit with, you know, an inability to get a straight job anywhere. Like,
yeah,
who's going to hire a felon when you could hire a non-felon in our kind of job market? So it's like, we don't make any of the right choices to try to help people out that need the help. And, yeah, it's like, we'd rather it's the powers that be. It's there's more money. You know, it's of greater political incentive to build more prisons and keep people in prisons than it is to give people health services, including mental health services.
Yeah. There's like, I think it's like 70, I remember hearing like $75,000. Is it a day per person? There's a large number tacked on to per body of people that are incarcerated.
It's definitely in the tens of thousands of dollars per year. And
maybe that's what it was, 75,000 a year per person. That's what
That seems right. That seems right. And it's like, yeah, there's so many better ways we could spend that money. And
sure, imagine.
I'm not saying we shouldn't abolish like prisons. Like, that's, I'm not, but it's like, who really belongs? And I think generally, like, if you look at the way that the war on drugs has fueled mass incarceration, the last time I checked, I think half of the federal prison population is nonviolent drug offenders. And so, like, I don't know. Some of these people are probably pretty high up in the game, and maybe I don't know. It's like, I think we're not addressing the drug problem with boots on the ground in the right way. What we really need is like comprehensive harm reduction and mental health services. Because a lot of people that suffer from addiction don't want to be addicts, but don't really have anywhere to turn. And especially the way that addiction is really stigmatized in our culture.
Yeah.
Doesn't incentivize people reaching out to get the help that, again, doesn't exist for them.
Yeah, there's no nuance to the approach. There's a blanket approach, and it's archaic, and it's proven to have failed, you know? And we're also failing to implement any new approaches. But, I mean, I don't mean to be completely jaded about it. I know there are efforts, you know?
Sure.
But yeah,
There are. I mean, we need to see, like, decriminalization for possession, for petty small quantity possession across the board would be like a really common sense step. Even just like sentencing reform, on it's like, again, it just doesn't make sense. The punishment doesn't fit the crime, especially if you look at like how long someone selling psychedelics goes to prison for versus someone who commits DUI and recklessly endangers other people's lives.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would love to see some more nuanced discussions and approaches to that, for sure, man. And I really appreciate you giving a voice to the plants today, man. You speak on behalf of the plants, and you're
Thank
you're
you. That means a lot to me.
If plants could talk, man. So thank you, Dean.
I love that.
Yeah. All right. Appreciate your time, man. We'll do this again sometime.
Cool. I would love that, Garrett. Have a great one.
Cool. If everyone could please like, review, and subscribe to the podcast and hit that share button, we would both appreciate that greatly. Peace.